what's the deal with you and Mourinho? You're not a Roma fan, right? He was like, no, I'm just a Mourinho fan. I mean, I have trouble relating to the crazy Messi and Cristiano fans, but at least you can see Messi and Cristiano happen. He's like, my wife, and I was shocked that this guy was married, but anyway, my wife is a fan of Beyonce, and I'm a fan of Mourinho. The way I see football is you support the team. You are a fan of an institution. How valuable are you to Manchester United? So in reality, you're not that important to the club.
Hello, 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 everyone, and a warm, warm welcome to another episode of the What's Going On podcast. It's me, Jacob, talking. I'm here with Chua today. How are you doing?
I'm good, mate. Buzzing to be joined by Gabriele Cardi, one of the biggest names in football journalism.
Exactly, because we're not alone today. Welcome, Gab.
Hi, Jacob. Hi, Chua. Delighted to be able to join you.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you on. It's an honor to have you on our show. Been really exciting. And we're super excited to talk to you, too.
So, you say that to every single podcast guest you have.
But it's cool, you know, interviewing a guy who I've seen, you know, so many times on ESPN FC, on TV, on, you know, Twitter and so on. So it's honestly an honor having you here.
It's my pleasure, boys.
But yeah, Gab, I was wondering if to start us off, if you could tell us a bit about, you know, your journey so far and your current role at ESPN FC and in general what you're doing.
My personal journey? I'm Italian. I was actually born literally across the street from San Siro. My dad, because of his job, tended to be posted different places around the world. So I had a bit of an unusual upbringing. I left Milan when I was 3. I lived in Chicago. I lived in Poland. I lived in Germany. Lived in New York. Lived in Tokyo. And I finished school in London, where I'm based now. And then I went to university in the United States, and then to grad school in the United States. And then around that time, and so much of this job, probably so much of life, is about being lucky and being kind of things happening to you at the right time. So just after I finished grad school at Columbia University, it was the Atlanta Olympics. So I went down there to cover the Olympics, met a bunch of people, and it was also, of course, 96. It was also the summer of Bosman, when so many things changed in football around Europe. And so then my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife, said, I really want to go live in London. So I said, all right, well, all these footballers are coming to the Premier League, many of them from Italy. Or from Serie A anyway, let's go and let's give it a shot. Let's go and start their freelancing. So that's what I did. It also happened to coincide with the development of mobile phones. And back then, obviously, everybody had one, like now, but the difference is back then, like, you really just used it to call people. And back then, it was still kind of a novelty. So, like, professional footballers, you could just call them up and they would actually answer the phone and have a conversation with you, which I guarantee you doesn't happen today unless you know them. So I just started there. And I guess one of the biggest things in 2003, I became the European or the world football columnist for The Times, replacing Simon Cooper, who good friend and an excellent football journalist. Did that for a long time. 2012, I started working for ESPN, and then I kind of moved full-time to ESPN in 2015, I want to say. And now for ESPN, I write a column twice a week. I appear on the FC show, I do a show with Julian Lawrence, the Gab and Jules show, which goes out as a podcast, goes out on YouTube, goes out on different ESPN channels, different ESPN territories around the world, where we kind of just talk about football and what happened in the previous days for an hour or so.
Yeah, similar to us, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Sound like a dream to do this for a living. But can you describe a little bit of how life is if you work as a football journalist? how does a regular day look for you, and also a regular week? It may be hard to tell, but can you describe a little?
So during the season, and like I think this is going to be different for different people, right? So what I do is I'm a columnist. I give opinion. I give analysis. It's going to be very different for somebody who, say, you know, covers Real Madrid or Manchester United. There's pros and cons to it. You know, if you cover one team, obviously you go more in depth on that, and you know, you're fully focused on that. You may not know what's going on elsewhere. Mm. I have the luxury of looking at things more broadly, but equally, what it means is that, you know, every weekend there's maybe 11 or 12 clubs around Europe, and it's the ones you can imagine, the big six in England: Real Madrid, Barcelona, Atleti, Bayern, Juventus, Milan, Inter, Borussia Dortmund, and Paris Saint-Germain. I watch all their games, all of them. Which part of the downside of spending so much time in front of the television is during the week I can't actually get to a football game unless, because of where I live, unless it's Chelsea, Fulham, or Arsenal at home on a Saturday. Fortunately, in London, usually, or Brentford. I've been to Brentford too. Fortunately, in London, one of those four teams is generally always at home, but London's a big place. Even getting out to watch West Ham or going north to watch Spurs becomes difficult. And Crystal Palace, forget about it. So you actually watch less football in person, certainly on weekends. I do try to get out to Champions League games, whether in London or around Europe.
All right.
So I do that, and I put the show together, and then I spend a lot of time just talking to people. You know, yesterday I went for lunch with the agent of a well-known Chelsea player. I spend a lot of time on the phone and on WhatsApp. One of the few good things about having done this for a long time and getting old is that you know a lot of people, and they return your calls. And even the ones you don't know, you know, if you just message them, they'll generally get back to you, and they'll want to have a relationship with you, want a conversation with you. And if you can prove to be trustworthy and reliable, you know, you can kind of get to what is going on. You can kind of generally get to the truth, or some semblance of the truth. I know you do that a lot by speaking to people on background, speaking to people confidentially, because, you know, these are such public figures, especially club officials and coaches, that they're not going to say stuff on the record unless they really have something to say, right?
Right.
That they want out there. So generally, that's what a big chunk of my time is spent doing.
Wow, that's really cool to hear.
What do you like most about it?
You know, that question's come and gone over the years. It's been different. Fundamentally, philosophically, what I like most about football and about doing this job is I like that people care about football. And I like the fact that it's a diversion, right? You know, I used to say when you pick up a newspaper, but I don't think anybody does that anymore. But when you look at the news, right? If you go to your favorite news website, there's going to be news that you feel you need to know, right? And it might be politics, it might be business, it might be what's going on in Ukraine. You don't read it because you want to, you read it because you need to know, right? Because it's useful to you, it makes you a better citizen, it makes you a better consumer, it makes you all make more informed choices, whatever. But sport, like entertainment, you know, unless we have this mental illness we call fandom, where you can't but, you know, generally, it is entertainment. It is a break from people's lives. They don't need to do this. And so for me, the fact that, you know, you choose to go and listen to me and Jules talk about football, or you choose to go and read an article I wrote, that's a privilege. You know, there's a lot of other people out there writing the same stuff. You can go somewhere else. But you're choosing to give up your free time to go and read this or to go and listen to this. And I think that gives you a lot of satisfaction. And I think it also spurs you to try and do the best possible job that you can do. You know, my colleague Mark Ogden likes to say that, you know, PR is printing what people want you to write, and journalism is printing what people don't want you to write.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, it's a classic phrase. I don't think he coined it. But, you know, there's a lot of people who – I'll give you an example, right? So, Chwap, what team do you support or did you support when you were a kid?
I support Manchester United.
Okay. So if Manchester United announced that, you know, they're going to – I don't know. They're going to sign Kolomwani next season from Icar. You don't care how you find out, right? It can be me. It can be somebody else. It can be somebody on Twitter. It can be something here on the radio. You just want that item of news, right? Yeah, that is PR, right? That is the equivalent of either Manchester United putting out a press release or, as often happens with football clubs, Manchester United paying a comms guy or an agency to go to, usually it's an in-the-know journalist, usually it's more than one, and say, hey, this is happening tomorrow, right? And then it becomes a race. You want to know first. You want to be the first guy to know, right? That makes no difference. There's no differentiation there. But then if you want to know, if you want an analysis of how Kolomwani fits into Manchester United, how it's going to work, how he did before at his old club, what kind of a player he is, so on, what he likes to do in his private life, feature story about him, then you have to go beyond that, right? Then it goes beyond the PR side. So I like to think that that's kind of the role that we fill. And by the way, sorry, when I mentioned the in the know guys, and I used to cover the transfer market myself, so I do have a lot of sympathy for them. There are some guys who are outstanding at breaking stories that others don't want out. And they don't do it by betraying trust. They do it by understanding that in a transfer, there's multiple bits involved and you piece together different bits of information. That is really good old school reporting. There are some people who do that who are exceptional at it. And then there's other people who, you know, just wait to get the call from the club press officer.
Yeah. Who would you say some of those people are?
People who are really, really good. I feel like I'm kind of, I don't know, it's a cop-out question, but I don't want to leave anybody out. What I will say, I think there's another important role, though, to be played here. And it's something that, you know, a guy like Fabrizio Romano, who I think is very good at what he does, and he's very open about this, is that he's kind of, it used to be about him being first. Now what he wants to do is he wants to be accurate. So a lot of times, I think what he does is somebody will report a story. You can do this when you have 15 million followers on Twitter, whatever it is. He will confirm it. Right, he can go straight to the source and say, yes, no, this is right, this is wrong. And I think that's – and now he's at the stage where people come to him, you know, agents and clubs come directly to him. So I think that's how you should do the job, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really, really – I think it's a really, really important role right now, that I think just being able to properly confirm – other people's stories, and then you give them credit. And hey, like, you were first, that's fine. But I, as a reader, if I want to build trust, if I want to engage, I need to be able to confirm it. And unfortunately, what we're seeing, you know, this industry moves so quickly that sometimes stuff doesn't get confirmed, or you get like the kind of like the double boomerang conversation. This used to happen more, but it still happens today, right? Where over here the Daily Mail will write that, oh, Manchester United are on the verge of signing Kolomwani. And then Eintracht Frankfurt, or sorry, a paper in Germany, will come out and say, we'll see the story, pick it up, you know, do some cursory reporting, but then be like, oh, like, Kolomwani headed to Manchester United. And then the next day, the Daily Mail will be like, oh, look, they wrote it in Germany. Okay, it must be true, right? Like, confirmation that, and you know, that happened a lot more, but it's still like, there is a lot of that going on. So having people who do the reporting, who go and confirm the story, I think is really important. By the way, I'm not picking on the Daily Mail. They have excellent people as well. But I think you have to do, they do a good job actually. I think there's another role media can do, because ultimately people are obsessed with transfers, is put the source, right? And the Daily Mail do that. So Daily Mail, I'm not picking on you. I used to freelance years ago. But, you know, you can make up your own, you can make up your own mind. When you look and you, you know, they have the headline of the story, and then they'll be like, you know, according to such and such paper, such and such website, you develop some savvy about, all right, who is that website or that paper? Mm. Are they close to? How reliable are they likely to be on this story? Do I need to pursue it? Where is the story likely to come from? I don't think, contrary to what people may think, I don't think media make things up. It's just that sometimes what happens is they don't go and check whether something is accurate, or they take kind of, they allow themselves sometimes to be manipulated, and sometimes they kind of take kind of like, you know, half snippets as good.
All right. And you mentioned kind of, you know, the, finding the balance between accuracy and speed, which is naturally a challenge and, you know, in your profession. But, you know, as a seasoned journalist, what would you say in general are some of the biggest challenges you guys face? Like, are there any trends or issues that you find particularly concerning?
I mean, it's not a challenge for me because I don't really do news anymore, right? Mm. So I don't have that. I don't have to make those big decisions. I'm not an editor. I don't have to make those big decisions about accuracy versus speed. Yeah. And I'm grateful for that. I remember when I worked for the Times, the credo there was, you know, we're the Times. We don't need to be first. We just need to be right. And we don't need to be the ones giving you the what. We want to be the ones giving you the why, right? Right. To have that understanding of it. I think one of the things that I'm really fascinated with, and I was going to write a piece about this, is obviously social media has changed a lot of things, and you become very aware about how fans in different parts of the world sort of process the club. And you as a United fan, you'll appreciate this, right? It's what I find really interesting. For example, I'll mention Chelsea as an example because it's near my house. I go there often. If you go to Chelsea and you sit in the stands and you talk to fans, there's a lot of people who are way down on Todd Boehly right now for obvious reasons, right? On this ownership. There's a lot of people who are like, man, when Roman was here, but not just him, but like Marina Granovskaya, Peter Cech, these guys knew what they were doing. They were good, blah, blah, blah. But I now like, you know, this is like a Muppet show now, right? That there's a lot of negativity surrounding that. There's some people on social media who, you know, Chelsea's results notwithstanding, will be like, no, Boehly saved the club, get behind Boehly, blah, blah, blah. And I think there's often a tension between the local fan, the local match-going fan, and not tension in the sense they disagree, and the fan who experiences it from afar, the fan who experiences it via television, by news groups, by a social, only that. I think there's two different experiences, and I think how clubs relate to the two sets of fans, I think is going to be an increasing topic for them to deal with. Because actually, if you don't mind, I'll ask you this question, Chuck, all right? Since we have a United fan here. So people always talk about global markets, commercial opportunities, lucrative Asian markets, all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And then you dive into actually like a club's business, and you realize that, and United might be somewhat of an exception because they have a great commercial operation, but you kind of realize that like they actually make most of their money locally. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to ask you now, I'm curious, how valuable are you to Manchester United compared to, you know, Joe Bloggs, who you know, lives in Stockport and is a season ticket holder at Old Trafford, right? So yeah. Let me ask you this, right? Do you go to Old Trafford? Have you been to Old Trafford this year?
I have not. No. Okay.
Have you bought any official kit from the club store?
I have. I have the season's kit.
Is that all you bought? How much do you think you've spent this season on official Manchester
United gear? Unofficial United gear? I've probably spent, I'd say maybe around 100 pounds,
100
euros,
okay,
something like that. So not as much as Joe from Stockport.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm driving at, right? Do you, I mean, I don't know, but I, in Sweden, are Manchester United on pay television? Do you pay?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah,
they are. Yeah. Okay. And how much do you pay monthly for that subscription?
Probably around £40.
Okay.
£40 a month for Premier League, Champions League, and yeah.
All so of with that £40, it, obviously it's not £40 a month or £480 a year that goes to Manchester United.
Yeah,
it all gets divided up amongst all the different sports that they show and the Champions League, and it gets divided up. I'm guessing in the £480 that, again, I don't know what the TV deal is in Scandinavia, but I'm guessing if United get maybe £2 or £3 out of that, they're probably doing well.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So we're at £102. And by the way, if you bought the official kit, as you probably know, it's not like United get £100.
It's Adidas. Yeah.
Yeah, they have an upfront thing. They'll get a royalty. So in reality, you're not that important to the club. Do United have sponsorship deals in Sweden? Like, is somebody like, we're the official beer of Manchester United in Sweden? Do they have any deals like that that you know of?
Nothing I know of, yeah.
So there's nothing local, right, in Sweden?
No, no. It's also like in Sweden, Manchester United are not that big as it is in, for example, Norway. I don't know 100%, but I could imagine that they've done something like that in Norway.
I'm still imagining Manchester United are probably one of the top five non-Swedish clubs, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I would say that.
But what I'm saying is, if it's like that for Sweden, for Manchester United, right, who are one of the two or three biggest clubs in the world, can you imagine what it's like for other clubs?
That's tough.
I think we've been through a period where people have talked about globalization and so on, and what they find is that there's an enormous audience out there outside of the local audience, but the local audience, for now at least, is still more lucrative and more visible because they're the ones who are actually in the stands. I know there's all the jokes about Norwegian tourists coming to Old Trafford. realistically, right? And so to me, that creates a really, really fascinating dynamic is how do you talk to these two different constituencies? Do you need to talk to them differently? Clubs have been asking themselves, how can I monetize all these people around the world? There's a story I heard from my friend who used to be in the commercial department at Barcelona, where they worked out that, oh, look, we have 250,000 hardcore fans in Indonesia. This is maybe like 10, 20 years ago. And they said, great. Like, how do we know that they're there? Because they registered on our Indonesian website, or it was like an Indonesian partner website. They registered as Barcelona fans. And they're like, okay, great. Let's sell them the club kit. Problem was, the club kit at the time was like, 60, 70, 80 euros. And these guys couldn't actually buy it. They couldn't afford it, right? Because that was a ton of money there. And in Indonesia, they could go and they could buy a fake replica kit for 5 euros, right? And nobody's going to tell the difference. So then they were like, how do we actually make money off these people? I'm not saying clubs just want to make money, right? But it's an interesting...
It is a business.
Right? It is a business, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, my great point, actually. Like,
yeah.
When you think about it like that.
No, I haven't thought of it in that way. I've only thought it like benefited a club like Manchester United to have such a big fan base worldwide.
Yeah, but it does help with like, brand deals for sure.
Yeah, it does. But it's also like a cool discussion to like have, like how much are you actually getting out of it as a club?
Yeah. Yeah, no question about it. And I think like the other thing with brand deals is, with those, if you can tell people that you have 500 million fans around the world, then you're more likely to get more money from it and they get exposure and so on. But what I've also learned by diving a little bit into deep is sometimes the brands don't really know what they're getting, how to price that value. If you've seen Arsenal play, you see the little Visit Rwanda thing. You know where that comes from. So the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, is a massive Arsenal fan. You can find tweets of his going back to like 2008. Talking about Wenger and Martin Keown or whatever, right? So the Rwanda Tourist Board does a deal with Arsenal. Now, I don't know how much they pay. There's nothing wrong from Arsenal's perspective. I do wonder if, you know, if he'd been a Real Madrid fan or if he'd been a Manchester United fan, whether that deal would be with a different club, right? There's a lot of that going on as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And even like with the Spotify founder wanting to buy Arsenal because he's an Arsenal fan. So you do see the team support does play quite a role, it seems.
Yeah.
With sponsorships and purchasing of clubs.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. Going back a little bit back to like journalism, what would you say are like the key factors today in order to be a top journalist with everything going on in social media and digitalization, which is also a challenge? What are your thoughts about it?
I think one of the obvious ways the system's changed is you have to be able to work across different media. You know, when I'm so old that when I actually started out, you know, we had email and we had the web, but it was kind of in its infancy, right? So if you were a newspaper journalist, and that was really the where the majority of football journalists were, you know, it was a case of you would file your story, you would write a story, you would collect information during the day, file your story by the deadline, and then that was it, right? There was no alternate narrative. There's no more news cycle until the next day. And I think you can't do that today, right? Today, you're constantly updating what you produce because as stories break and evolve. And you have to appear in different media. You have to appear on radio. You have to appear on television. You have to appear online. So you don't have to have a presence on social, but it certainly helps you to do that. I think those are massive changes. Another massive change, at least on the business side, you know, about how the job is done is WhatsApp. Because I know other people use other messaging apps, but that once you have your group of contacts, it's just so fast. It's so versatile, this kind of messaging, that you can generally know if they've read your message or not. Although, of course, there's a way to not make it turn blue or whatever. But it means you're on call a lot more. But it also gives you a lot more access. And I think it's also, it's harder to hide. It's you know, before people would read one paper. And so if you write a story for a newspaper and you write a load of nonsense, but it's really not that important, your readers wouldn't really know unless they read multiple newspapers. But most of them probably wouldn't because, you know, who other than weirdos and journalists buys 3 or 4 newspapers? there's no comparison in social media. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Now I think it's harder. It's harder to bullshit. It's, you know, it's more difficult. People will call you out if you say stuff that's incorrect or if you're
easily for sure.
astray.
Yeah, there's so many more sources out there. And actually on that point, people calling out and so on, today with social media, there's naturally a lot of, you know, abuse and so on, right? From lots of social media trolls. How do you deal with those?
So the ones that bug me are the guys with like, you know, zero, like 2 followers and their name and it's a bunch of numbers.
Yeah.
No picture, just like a cartoon or
yeah. They're everywhere.
I mean, I think in my experience, most people, and others will disagree with me, and others have had really bad experiences, especially women have really, really been treated very badly online. So I don't want to make light of this. In general, if you respond to somebody, you know, sometimes they can be civil and you can have a conversation and you can agree to disagree. But you also run into other people who just see the world differently. You also run into other people who are just like idiots and like, you know, sitting there banging on their thing. Like, but then there's other people who really see the world differently. I had this long, long back and forth with this guy. I think he's either in India or the Gulf. And it was over Jose Mourinho, right? And whatever, I think it was when Roma had lost like 6-1 to Bodo Glimt conference last year. And, you know, Mourinho Day came up with stupid excuses and whatever. And so, you know, I pointed out that, look, you're at Roma. You made the team spend a lot of money. you know, you're saying, you know, I think what it was is he said that his players weren't good enough, whereas, you know, last year they'd the year before they'd reached the Europa League semifinal or final or whatever. It's that this guy got engaged and, you know, and he was quite vicious at the beginning, and then we kind of argued and so on. And then, and ultimately I said, like, why are you, what's the deal with you and Mourinho? You're not a Roma fan, right? Like, are you, like, no, I'm just a Mourinho fan. I'm a fan of, you know, we were the Spurs, United, Chelsea. Like, I just support him wherever he goes.
Right.
And that's not something I can relate with. I mean, I have trouble relating to the crazy Messi and Cristiano fans, but at least you can see Messi and Cristiano out there. This idea of being a fan of a guy who, you know, is a coach.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's too many of them.
And yeah, when he says, like, you know, for me, it's normal. Like, and he says, like, you know, he's like, my wife, and I was shocked that this guy was married, but anyway, like, my wife, Beyonce, and I'm a fan of Mourinho. And to the point that, like, you know, when he started telling me about how his wife, like, I don't know, she was on different, like, Reddits and stuff about Beyonce and stuff, and she gets aggressive when people criticize Beyonce, and she buys Beyonce products, and she live streams Beyonce concert. And I'm like, I mean, I'm not into Beyonce at all, but I can kind of get, like, at least there's music there. There's Mourinho.
Things iconic quotes.
Yeah, no, but it is that living football, right? Through celebrities, right? And yeah, you see that. You see that we've all encountered the Messi, Cristiano guys on social media, right?
Yeah.
It's different. You know, for me, you know, you can be a fan of people, but the way I was raised, the way I see football is you can really only love and obsess, you know, the teams that you support. And you support the team. I don't support the players of my team. I don't support the owner of my team. The only thing that matters to me is, you know, the badge and the colors. And that's it, right?
Yeah.
Everything else, you need to win me over every single time. And my natural setting is to be cynical, right? Everything has to be earned every day to me as a fan. To me, that is what you are, a fan of an institution.
Yeah.
Other people, they're unconditional fans of individuals, which, hey, it's their prerogative. I do find it slightly scary because I can also get into populism and the cult of personality and all this other stuff. But hey, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it is something you see in, like, smaller countries often who have a star player, like Zlatan Ibrahimovic, for example.
Yeah.
A lot of Swedish people became fans of Inter Milan, AC Milan, Juventus, Manchester United.
Every one of them. I follow Zlatan in every club he played, you know, and I actually fell in love with one of the clubs he played for, AC Milan. But that was, if Zlatan would have played there, maybe I wouldn't have started to, like, support the club and stuff. So,
I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt. Would you agree that Zlatan's done some stupid things sometimes, and sometimes he gets things wrong? Or do you think Zlatan
100%, for sure.
So there's a level. So you love Zlatan, but you don't love him unconditionally to the point that, you know, he can do no wrong and he's always right. So
no, exactly. I love what he does on the pitch, but that's it.
You realize he's a human being, and sometimes you probably agree with some of the stuff he says, some of the stuff he doesn't, some of the stuff you find funny, because ultimately he is a human being, right? So when Zlatan says, when he keeps doubling down on his criticism of Pep, for example, which I think he's doing tongue-in-cheek to be like the character Zlatan, but, you know, so many people out there are Zlatan fans will be like, oh, yeah, no, Pep Guardiola's a talentless fraud. Yeah, no. Zlatan's right. Messi's shit, too. And, like, Zlatan was greater than all.
Yeah. He has some really, like, poor arguments out there. Yeah. Yeah. Who do you, may I ask, which team you support?
So when I was a kid, I was an Inter fan. But I wouldn't describe myself as an Inter fan today. And part of the reason is I think fandom means you have to give unconditional love to the team, to the institution. Again, not the players, not the owner, not the coach, but just to the institution, right? It has to mean something to you. And equally unconditional criticism of your rivals. And the problem is when you're in this job, it's really difficult to do that when you actually meet them. You know, they say you should never meet your heroes. And you might find out that, you know, some of the people that you're supposed to hate because they play for other teams and they represent other teams and stuff are actually intelligent, creative, wonderful human beings. And some of the people who are on your team are complete fuckwits. So, or dishonest or whatever.
Yeah.
So for me, you know, I'm not going to claim to be unbiased. I will support Italy if we ever qualify for another World Cup, which I'm not sure about. But but when it, so I can't claim to be unbiased, but yeah, no, I'm a fan of individuals. There's people I like because I admire what they do. I admire how they behave. But I'm not going to unconditionally support a team other than my national team.
All right. Yeah, interesting to hear. Highlights so far of your career.
Highlights, like I've been fortunate to have been able to witness some of the greatest games, some of the greatest moments. I worked out that I'm going to the Champions League final in Istanbul. And wow. It's going to be my 19th Champions League final. You know, I've covered 7 World Cups, I think. So, yeah, so I can, you know, on the pitch, greatest moments that I can remember are 2005 Istanbul, Liverpool coming back from 3-0 down at halftime and kind of, you know, moving into the twilight zone. Greatest moment personally as a fan that I've also covered as a journalist, no question about it. Semi-final of the 2006 World Cup between Italy and Germany.
Yeah, what a game. A
crazy game.
With Del Piero and Grosso, I think.
Yeah, Fabio Grosso.
Yeah, it's one of the loudest atmospheres I've ever... I know, to be able to beat Germany in Germany. And I know, yeah. And I say this, I used to live in Germany. I have... But it's obvious, Germany's a team that, you know, it's like the cartoon villain, right, in Europe. If you ask, like, if you ask the English, you know, ooh, who are your big footballing rivals? Like, well, Germany, of course. And, you know, you ask the Dutch, oh, it's Germany, right? And I would like to humbly point out that, okay, you guys, with your combined 1 World Cup more than Albania, go away. Germany only has one rival, and it's us because, you know, we won 4 World Cups like Germany. But, you know, the reality is Germany are the top dog. And I think we admire so much about them, and that is why we're all really, really big rivals. We all want to be Germany's rival, right? You know, all due respect, nobody wants to be Norway's rival. Maybe an oil extraction or something, or winter sports, but yeah.
But which league or tournament would you say in general you prefer covering?
I'm going to give you an absolute cop-out because I generally like I like all of them. I like all levels of football. I think there's always something to look for. There's always something interesting going on if you know what to look for, if you know how to watch a football game in a certain way. Obviously, I think the technical level in La Liga is just higher than any of the other tournaments in terms of the actual technical ability of the players. And I know there's probably just as many skillful players in the Premier League, but it's just the way the game is played. And the fact that there are also some teams that choose not to use technical players, you know, that makes a difference. The Premier League, I think, has, for me, the best coaches out there who are given the most freedom to really go and shape their teams. I mean, it's not just Klopp and Pep who are the, you know, the two obvious choices of people who've kind of been totally handed the keys to the kingdom. Or no, to be fair, they earned it, right, by being successful. But even seeing, you know, I don't know that Erik ten Hag could have had the same kind of impact at Manchester United effectively on his own this year. I don't know that that could have happened in Spain or Italy or even Germany. So I really enjoyed that aspect of the Premier League. I enjoy the pace of the Bundesliga. I do feel a little, I enjoy like kind of the storylines that have to do with, you know, Freiburg and Streich and Union Berlin kind of playing this totally almost like a different sport. And, you know, I enjoy sitting there waiting for Borussia Dortmund to throw it all away.
But you think they will?
I don't know. I don't think so. Maybe this is the year. I enjoy the fact that for all the stereotypes we chuck out there about German efficiency, German business, and look, there's no arguing with 10 league titles. I kind of sometimes want to go and shake Bayern Munich. My friend Rafa Honigstein says that Munich is the northernmost Italian city. And I know exactly what he means because, you know, that place is still a cluster mess. I don't care if they make money every year and they win the title, but their capacity for self-harm, for leaks, for double crosses. I mean, it's like a medieval court there, right? I obviously have strong historical ties to Serie A. I love the fact that, and what I love about the Bundesliga and Serie A, probably more so the Bundesliga, though, is that, you know, the fans don't see themselves as customers. Or there's still, obviously there's fans who don't see themselves as customers, but the fans don't allow themselves to be treated as customers. I think that's important. To me, football clubs are not just businesses. To me, they're social trusts, they're public trusts. And I think that's important. That's an important part of the conversation. Still very much so in Germany, in Italy, less so. And like Jose Mourinho, who am I to argue with him? And I don't want to upset my friend on social media. He says it's the toughest league. And so I'll trust them. I love the battles that go on. And I also love the evolution, the fact that, you know, until a few years ago, it was very obvious that, you know, there's a certain style to Italian football and they have this reputation for being defensive and counterattacking. And, you know, you see it now and you've got teams that want to win and entertain, especially small teams. They get the whole 3 points for a win thing. And I think that's wonderful. I haven't mentioned anything nice about Ligue 1. There are really nice things about Ligue 1 as well.
Produce a lot of talent.
Yeah, they do, for sure.
A lot of good young French players. But basically all the top five leagues. But if you had to pick one to watch, if you could only watch one for the rest of your life, which one would you watch?
Oh, I wouldn't. I just watch the NFL and watch my Philadelphia Eagles.
Is that the team?
If you told me I'm going to watch one league, I'd rather watch nothing. Honestly, yeah? I love watching. I mean, I love watching the contrast. I love watching the different styles. To me, that's part and parcel of the sport, you know, especially how it's globalized with the players and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you put a gun to my head and said you only have to watch one league in the world, I would say I'm going to watch the NFL. So.
All right.
Good answer on that one. That's a good answer. And now, actually, when Chua said that we're going to have you on, the thing I was super curious about was to talk a little bit about football or soccer, as they say in the US. And that is something that I want to talk a little bit about. First of all, do you say football or do you say soccer?
So I say football. But if I am talking in a context where the people understand a different kind of, people understand American football as football, I would have no trouble saying soccer. I do have a personal grudge and an entrenched hatred towards a type of person, which often exists actually in the US, who are fans of football as we know it in Europe and South America. And they're the people who correct you and say, it's football, not soccer. And what I want to do with these people is, seriously, I want to take a sledgehammer and bash their heads out. Or, no, I can't be violent like that. I want them to learn the history of the word. Because I want them to, you know, realize that Sir Matt Busby, who did more for the sport in England, in this country, than almost anybody. He wrote a book called, was it called On Football? No, it's called On Soccer.
He did? I didn't know that.
Wow. I didn't look it up. Until the 1980s, broadsheet newspapers use the term soccer very, very liberally. The word soccer, as you know, comes from the word association. When, you know, what we know as rugby and what we know as football started off roughly the same time, and both called themselves football. So one was known as rugby football, the other one was known as association football, and rugby football became just rugby, and association football became soccer, and it stayed like that for a long time. And, you know, I live in England. They had, or they still have, going to go off the air this year, a show called Soccer AM, and it's on Sky. It's called Sky Soccer Saturday. It's not called Sky Saturday. Like, these semantics to me just drive me, just absolutely drive me up the wall. And it's very rarely, I'll tell you what, I don't want to say it's never English people, because sometimes it is English people, but if it's English people, it's almost never football fans. It's, you know, rugby fans, cricket fans, I don't know, netball fans, people who, because, you know, there's a big class system in this country until very recently. Middle-class people and upper-middle-class people, the perception was that they really weren't interested in football at all, right? That's, they have this whole myth here in this country about the working man's game and whatever.
Yeah.
Those were the ones that would correct you on it, right? Because it's stupid. They don't know the sport. They don't know the reality of it. They don't know the history of it. But, yeah. So feel free to use whatever term you like. My personal choice is to modulate it based on the expectations of the people I'm talking to, just as a courtesy.
Really good answer. And also, like, super interesting to know, because I didn't know that about the word soccer. And also, like, as you said, that there are actually some shows that are actually in England that is called, that you use soccer. So that is also
literally, like, the biggest show on Sky, bankroll the Premier League, is called Soccer Saturday.
Which
that's ironic.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, talking about, like, Americans then, we've seen, like, quite a few American investors invest in football clubs in Europe. Why do you think they see this as a big and a good opportunity for them to invest their money instead of maybe investing in, like, NBA clubs or NFL clubs or NHL clubs? What is your take on it?
So I think there's different answers to that. One is that if you want to invest in the NFL or NBA, or NHL, they have a peculiar setup where obviously it's a closed league and it's very expensive to do so. Clubs don't come up for sale very often, and each sale has to be approved by the owners of the league. I don't know if it's a simple majority or if it's a three quarters majority or whatever. So there's some individuals who have bought football clubs who probably couldn't buy an NFL team. The other thing, and they're changing the rules on this a little bit, but in the major American sports, you can have smaller owners, but certainly in the NFL, and I think the NBA as well, it has to be individuals, right? You can't, I can't set up a fund, call it Clear Lake, collect money from, you know, 100,000 different people and go and buy the LA Lakers. I can't do that. So that's kept certain private equity players or hedge funds, that's kept them out of investing in that. The other obvious question is that the obvious reason is that football is the number one sport in the world by some margins. And I think, you know, they want to be a part of that. It is definitely growing in the US, whether it's going to grow to the point where it becomes a lucrative business, I'm not 100% sure, or a super lucrative business. But for many of these people, it's like buying a lottery ticket, right? I mean, if it does, they'll be absolutely minting it. If it doesn't, you know, it hasn't really cost them that much. And what we've seen is that they can generally sell and get their money back in most cases. Not that many. There's so many, like, when you get to be really rich, you get to be a billionaire, even when you invest in things, unless you're a complete moron, there's generally 101 things you can do to really mitigate your losses so that, you know, look, I've owned, you know, I don't know. I want to mention, I was going to say Aston Villa because Randy Lerner, because he's such a gentleman, is one of the few people who's actually lost enormous amounts of money owning football. But most other people, they'll raise money from investors, they'll leverage, they'll borrow money. There's all sorts of ways to do it where at the end, worst case scenario, they haven't lost a large amount. So I think that's how a lot of people view it in terms of buying football clubs. There are some who are convinced, and this is one of the reasons I've been so critical of Todd Boehly, that, American sports are the best in the world at monetizing fans and entertainment and so on, and we can extract all this money from them and be so profitable. Those cavemen in the Premier League don't understand anything. You know, I think his business partner in Bali actually said, like, we think, Premier League's about 20 years behind Major League Baseball. Leaving aside, really? Major League Baseball is generally dying. But anyway, seriously, it's so freaking boring that they had to put a clock on it to make the games go faster because nobody wants to watch it, okay? I don't know if we need lessons from these people, but whatever. But there are people who genuinely believe that. And, I mean, I think it's idiotic because, and I've written this, I have no reason to go back on this, like, hey, Todd, I know you're very proud of owning the LA Dodgers and everything, but you do realize that the Glazers, Stan Kroenke, Fenway, all these people own major U.S. franchises and major U.S. sports. Most of them more profitable, more successful than the one you own. And they've all been here in England for 10 plus years. And you don't think that none of this stuff ever occurred to them? You don't think it ever occurred to Manchester United that, hey, maybe we can monetize our fans better based on stuff we learned in the U.S.? The answer is, of course it did. And the fact that they didn't do it shows that maybe it's not such an obvious thing that you can just go in and, set up a North-South All-Star game or or launch a club app to monetize fans, whatever that means. So, there's a certain crassness behind, I think, some of it. I think many of them are just happy to go park their money, have a vanity asset that's likely to appreciate in price, that probably is going to break even. And if you do lose money, you're not going to lose very much money.
Yeah. Good answer. Interesting to hear. And talking about what's going on in the pitch then, like, what are your thoughts on the U.S. men's national team? Because they got quite a talented group with a good potential. Do you think that he can achieve something big, actually, in the World Cup 2026? Or is it too early for this young generation to actually be able to perform something in a big tournament?
I don't know if you're being polite, but I'm genuinely asking, right? You said it's a talent. Who do you support, Jacob?
I'm a supporter, of course, Sweden, and AIK is my club. It's a local club in Sweden. But otherwise, it's Milan, and in England, it's Manchester United. But I would say Milan and AIK, I would say.
Okay. How many U.S. men's national team players do you think could get into the Manchester United side?
They need a striker. So Balogun could definitely be a name for them. Maybe not a starting option, but he could be a
player. I'm assuming you wouldn't choose Balogun over Martial, with all due respect to Balogun right now.
Maybe not. That's true. But there's some, Musa, he's been linked with big clubs.
But are you going to draw? Who are you going to drop from United?
No one in the U.S. is starting at United.
Okay, so if you want to set the bar, the reason I'm messing with you, right?
Yeah. it's a good one.
We can take Milan as well if you want.
Yeah.
And you can do the same argument there. When everybody's fit at Milan, I'm not having Tyler Adams over Sandro Tonali. Or much as I love Yunus Musa, who, as you know, is eligible to play for Italy.
Yeah.
Is he better than Bennacer? I don't know.
I would take Tim Weah over Junior Macias or Selemakers, for sure. At the right wing,
Yeah, I think my wingers would be Leao and Pulisic, personally.
Yeah, Pulisic, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So I guess what I'm driving at is it's a very young team. I have the privilege of knowing Greg Berhalter, who, of course, was a coach at the World Cup a little bit. I think they were building towards something. I think it's a shame that I think it appears certain now that he's gone. I think they were really let down by what happened with Gio Reyna. When I look around and I look, who's actually super talented, Pulisic and Reyna are super talented. I don't know that anybody else is. It doesn't mean they can't form a good unit, but the super talented guys are two of them. And one of them, Pulisic, is a little bit odd, but is very good when he's fit, and he's often injured. The other guy, Gio Reyna, I think burned a lot of bridges with what happened in Qatar. He's, you know, it's not like he's 17 anymore, right? We're talking before about Borussia Dortmund possibly winning the title. I know he's come on, played a few minutes here and there, scored some big goals, but he's not fit. He's not regular. He's not a big part of the success. I think there's a lot to fix there. And they're going to need other people to come through and step in, you know. Sergiño Dest is an unquestioned starter for the U.S. men's national team. Can't get a game at Milan. You know, he played like twice. It was terrible. I have no idea what happened to him when they sent him back to Barcelona. And, you know, I don't know what Barcelona are going to figure out, because obviously Barcelona have a lot of things to deal with. You know, when you go through it, you've got a lot of guys who are good. You know, I don't want to use, to use the cliche, good, honest pros. But, you know, that value add isn't necessarily there. And I think also they also have another issue, which is, and Berhalter said this many times, he said, like, you know, it's great when we've got guys who are, you know, playing regularly for top teams, or even if they're off on the bench, they're training with top players. And I agree with him. That's really, really important. The problem is, by that metric, right now, it's not happening, because I have no idea what's going on with Reyna. Pulisic is either, you know, just playing a little bit, a few minutes here and there, or he's injured. You know, the other guys are getting relegated with Leeds United. You know, Tim Ream's like 37 years old. The other guy, the guy with the ponytail, Walker Zimmerman, or when he's still in MLS, with him. You know, your goalkeeper is a reserve at Arsenal. You know, you put all these things together, there's a lot of things that need to fall into place. I think they have the time to do it, and it is a young team, and they can grow together. And they're going to have to deal with the other thing that, you know, when 2026 rolls around in the U.S., the mainstream media are going to get involved, and they don't know about football. They think the U.S. men are as good as the U.S. women in terms of winning things. So, like, you know, they win a couple games, they'll start talking, well, what do you think, semifinal? No, I think they can win it all. Insulate them from putting that, you know, kind of tremendous pressure on them.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think it's going to take a while. Or rather, look, I'm going to say it's going to take a while, because the World Cup, it's 7 games. If you get to the final, anything can happen. But it's going to be difficult. Like, a lot of stars will have to align, I think, for the U.S. to have a meaningful tournament in 2026. And a lot of things are going to have to turn themselves around. And I think it's a really, really big job for anybody out there. It's a huge challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Hopefully they can develop. There's still a few years to go, and if they get like a good coach and stuff. So, yeah. But I agree with you. There's still like, there's a hype around the team, which is maybe not like 100% makes sense. So I agree with you, what you say.
Troy, would you take Balogun over Martial? Or even over Weghorst?
I have to be honest, I haven't actually watched him. But the fact that Arsenal haven't, you know, taken him back, I feel like they should have taken him back in January if he's that good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That is true.
You wouldn't take Pulisic over Rashford. Yeah?
Ah, no chance. No chance.
Would you take Musa over Bruno?
Who, sorry?
Would you take Yunus Musa over Bruno?
And no chance. Like, the only potential one would maybe be Balogun, just because of United's problems up front. But I mean, this summer we're going to get Harry Kane or Osimhen or someone like that. So
it's a different level.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that was actually it that we had to talk about U.S. soccer. And those were actually questions we had. So sorry if we stepped over the time a little bit. It was super interesting to talk to you.
Absolute pleasure having you on the show.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me on. I invite everybody out there, in addition to listening to the What's Going On podcast, to, if you don't already, check out Gab and Jules. Check out our podcast. We're also on YouTube, as you know. So I have to plug my own stuff.
It's a great show, by the way, Gab and Jules. So guys, listen to it.
Yeah, and also ESPN FC on YouTube to follow them. This class content there, which you also appear sometimes. So that's also a great advice for our followers. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, but so fun to have you on, Gab.
Great. Yeah. Enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Take care.
Have a good day.
Good one.
Take care. Bye, man.